Welcome to episode 14 of the What's Up podcast. My name is Martin, and I'm an engineer who builds instruments that astronomers then use to observe the universe.
I'm Alistair. I'm a final year PhD student. I'm studying active galactic nuclei.
Alistair today.
Did I call myself Ali last time?
Normally Ali.
I'll be Ali now.
In that case, I'll be Will today, and I help build stuff. I'm a scientist, but I generally spend my time working with engineers on the design of cameras and equipment to go on the back of telescopes.
So today we're going to talk about a few different things. We've got a story about some extragalactic black holes, the X-37B space plane, and some interesting discoveries about the moon Io. So let's start off with that stuff about Io.
The Io story was fun, so I just sort of saw this pop up on my Facebook feed, because it's
fake
not,
news,
not
fake
quite
news.
In the same box of stuff that I'm studying, but it was really interesting for a few different reasons. So Io is a very interesting place. It's the closest moon to Jupiter. It's similar in size to our own moon, and I think it's even slightly bigger, which is kind of impressive. And it's so close to Jupiter, it buzzes around every 1.8 days or something. And add on to that, it has other moons in the system alongside it, and this plus Jupiter plus the way the orbits work means Io gets squeezed by gravity, and you get a lot of tidal heating. So tidal forces are a little bit messy to actually talk about, but it's the same reason we have tides on the Earth. Mm-hmm. But
hence
it can really heat up this moon. So we're talking big changes because Jupiter's very massive, it's very close, and the other moons all act together to make Io the most volcanic spot in the entire solar system.
I think the usual analogy I use for this is if you get an elastic band and you stretch it a number of times, it starts to get a bit warmer.
Yes.
And it's the same principle. It's just you're imparting energy into that system and squeezing and expanding the moon in different axes, and that makes it heat up.
Now, a lot of the objects in the solar system, they all have internal heat, but a lot of that internal heat is residual from the formation of the objects, and a lot of that comes from radioactive elements that just decay naturally over time, whereas Io, the tidal heating's turned up to 11. So the radioactive decay is not really doing much, and this is all because of these gravity squeezes. But the result is you've got literally hundreds of active volcanoes. You have lava lakes. The entire surface is covered in amazing reds and yellows of sulfur deposits and all this really kind of weird stuff. We have videos now from New Horizons. There's a little graphic of a plume erupting into space and then raining back down with this giant umbrella of stuff. So it's already a fun moon. And this is an observation done from Earth, which is also unusual because up until we had spacecraft, we almost had no idea what Io would be like. We could guess that it might be volcanic because of these tidal forces, but nobody had seen it. And then the minute Voyager swam past it and took the pictures, everybody started to go, this is cool. So this was an observation from Earth with the Large Binocular Telescope. So this is a big 8.4 meters, but two of them stuck together, like just a giant pair of binoculars. But it can do two really cool things for modern astronomy. So it can use the two of them together to effectively act as a much bigger optical telescope. So that's the interferometry part. Mm-hmm. And they can use adaptive optics, which is getting down to Hubble level of resolution quality from the Earth's surface, which is very hard to do.
So adaptive optics basically just cancels out the motion of the atmosphere.
Yes. You get a little mini mirror as part of the setup that rapidly changes thousands of times a second, I think. Is that right? Yeah. And it can actively cancel out the wobbly stuff that makes stars twinkle. So
We're stopping stars twinkle, which is kind of sad.
We're getting better at this. Yeah. So they've got it working on their telescope, and it meant that the resolution that they got was incredible. So from Earth all the way down to this tiny point of light that is Io. And they also timed their observations. This makes it the third thing that makes it very cool, is that Europa was in the way. So it transited across the face of Io as seen from Earth. So you add that into the very high resolution observation.
Say that again.
Europa was in the way. So this is one of the other moons of Jupiter, one of the main four big ones. Every 6 years or so, Europa will pass in front of Io as seen from Earth. And you can use this on top of your observations to further constrain the brightness of hotspots on Io's surface.
Ooh,
so because you know physically where Europa is when it actually moves across a region, so even if you can't resolve it directly,
you can
know
see
where Europa is. So it sort of gives you an effective boost in resolution as well. So all of these things together meant they took a really good view of an active lava lake region on Io. So this is a lava lake that would fit somewhere between Edinburgh and Inverness. It's about 200 kilometres across. So that already made me go, this is quite big. And it's called Loci Patera. So it's a large region that once every 2 or 3 years actually actively resurfaces. So you have sort of fresh lava replacing the old stuff, which is kind of sinking down. and then the fresh stuff cools, and we are sort of studying this radiated heat that is coming off. So there's a huge amount of energy coming out of this lava lake.
Because there's no atmosphere to speak of,
very
is there,
thin
really?
One because of all the burps and farts that come from the volcanoes. But it's
kind of lost. You know, if there were no volcanoes, that atmosphere would sort of dissipate.
Pretty right? quickly, I think. Yeah, because it's something like a billionth the Earth sea level pressure. So yeah. It's there, but it's tiny.
Because that must affect the cooling somewhat, I think. Because obviously...
Yeah, if you've got a lot of air, you radiate heat away through, convect heat away through that.
Heat away from that mechanism. Yeah. Whereas if you're just radiating into free space, effectively, it must be really slow to cool. So these lakes must stay, well, I presume that's why they're lakes. They stay warm for ages, which is
Yeah, it's something awesome. Like 10 or 20% of the heat budget of Io is coming out just from this one spot. And so it's connected to the magma chamber underneath, and that's why it's staying relatively liquid on the top. But they've been able to work out they think there's been two waves that have gone round in a sort of circular motion to resurface the lake, because they can try and guess how old the lava is by looking at how hot it is in different corners of this lake. It has an island in the middle as well, so it's bizarre looking stuff. And I'm not going to talk any more about volcanology, because I wouldn't ever call myself an expert in that stuff, but I just thought this was fun for a lot of reasons. And we'll see more of Io in the future, because it's not the last thing that's going to swing by Jupiter. I think the nice thing about Jupiter is, because it's so fat, probes going further away than Jupiter will nearly always use Jupiter for a gravity assist as well, which is why New Horizons got some really nice footage. So most things will want to visit Jupiter anyway.
It's awesome, isn't it? Because a few years ago, I think the interpretation, a few hundred years ago, we thought the other planets might have looked a bit like our own, whatever. Then we got to a stage where we kind of assumed that things were quite dead outside Earth, really. That really Earth was the active, interesting planet, and most other planets were not that kind of, well, there'd be nothing like volcanoes or whatever. And then now we suddenly have this image of volcanoes on Io and these huge geysers and things around Enceladus and how
icy geysers, that was always kind of a, well, maybe there's no reason why you couldn't. And then you see it and then you go, right, cool. We're just going to add this to the list.
It's intriguing that it's the moons, not the planets. The planets themselves are actually, I'm not saying they're not active. There's a lot of turbulence in those atmospheres, but it's a kind of constant activity, I suppose. I'm not sort of like varying in the way that suddenly, boom, a volcano, whatever. I mean, it's just great.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see these active things when, as you say, we assumed everything was very dull and stationary and constant in the solar system.
Yeah, and something a bit dead.
Yeah, and in actual fact, a lot of these smaller bodies are very active and spewing stuff all the time. It is very exciting.
Yeah. We should probably say also that Jupiter's pretty visible at the moment, night sky, middle of the evening. It's, it's right. If you look south, you go outside at the moment, there's a big bright thing, it's Jupiter. And Io is there. Get a pair of binoculars and you can, good pair of binoculars and you can see it.
It's cool. You're unlikely to see the Europa Io conjunction.
Yes, and you won't be able to spot the hotspot, but it's there. It's there.
Well, there are eagle-eyed amateur astronomers who chase the transits, though. So you can see the moon's shadows going across Jupiter's surface, which is also kind of cool. I've never been lucky enough to see those with my own telescope.
You have a reasonable telescope, haven't you?
Yeah, but seeing one of the moons reappear from the Jupiter's shadow, I've seen that before, so that was interesting. So you get Jupiter sort of projects a shadow behind it, so you'll get a moon just sort of popping into existence. And that was one of the ways they measured the speed of light for the very first time.
It was, wasn't it?
Was timing how long it took for those eclipses to happen in between. It was pretty cool.
Indish.
Don't make me do maths.
I'll trust you. Google Doodle said it was true, didn't it?
Yeah. So on the topic of keen-eyed amateur astronomers, there's something else that's appeared in the news which both keen-eyed astronomers and keen-eyed aviation nerds have spotted, and that is the return to Earth of the X-37B. Now, does anyone know what that is?
Well, they shouldn't have spotted it.
That's super secret laser beams attached to sharks thing, is it?
which nobody knows about except for everybody else.
Yeah, so this is an aircraft actually built by Boeing, which was previously run by NASA. Well, so what's interesting about this is the spacecraft itself isn't overly secret. What is secret is what it's doing. So the X-37B was part of the X-Planes project. It was run by Boeing in this case, and it was previously owned by NASA up until about 1999, when it was transferred into the US Air Force, and particularly under DARPA, which is kind of the cool
laser beams with sharks on its head department.
Yeah, pretty much.
No, wait, laser beams with sharks on its head? No, they're very hard to do.
So what's happened here is that the X-37B has been up 4 times now, and the US Department of Defense will admit that it's gone up. They will say when it's launching, and they'll say how it's launching, and it goes on top of a rocket.
it's kind of noticeable. They can't not say.
It's really hard to hide a launch. So there's too many keen-eyed folks that know where to look and when to sort of see these things go up.
But what they won't talk about is what the spacecraft is doing or where it is. So they will not openly admit to what the orbital parameters are, what orbit it's in.
Can they work that out? People work that out from just looking at the launch and things?
Well, you can guess, but if you've got enough fuel, you could potentially move away from that.
So there's a couple of interesting things about this. One of the things that people are suspecting, and this we're getting into a little bit of the tinfoil hat brigade stuff.
I'm kind of perma-tinfoil hat these days.
One of the things that people are speculating it is being used for is testing next generation thrusters. So it's been shown that this is what was previously used for, and they're saying that this is what it's been used for again. People have been watching its orbit, so if you've got the right equipment, if you've got satellite tracking equipment, you can spot this. And amateurs will put it up online, and you can go to websites and you can actually get the transit times and you have a chance of seeing it. It's very small and it's very not dull, very dim, but you can spot it. But what they're saying is because this is using next generation thrusters, you could actually do a lot of different orbital parameters, and that could be what they're testing. Now, it does go lower than the ISS, very, very low orbit, which again is interesting because if you put spy satellites in low orbit to get higher ground resolution, you need more fuel to keep them in orbit for longer.
Yeah, because it was up there for ages, wasn't it?
So this one was up for 717 days.
Lower than the ISS?
Yeah.
That's impressive because that sort of, well, I don't know what altitude it was, but if it's lower, you're getting quite a bit of drag.
Yeah, and you're getting a lot of drag.
You need they had fuel to keep it.
Well, I mean, even the ISS has to reboost every now and again because the atmosphere is just a little bit still there.
And there's a good bit more atmosphere at these altitudes than there are for the ISS because it's a logarithmic fall off.
So for those who haven't seen the picture, it is just a space shuttle shrunk with no windies.
It's actually pretty, so it's completely unmanned. That's the key point. And it's only 10 meters long, 5 meters wide, and 3 meters high. So if you're standing next to it, it's actually not that big, but it looks like a baby shuttle. It would fit inside the shuttle's payload space quite nicely.
Right. And it's just got the black heat tiles on the bottom and the white on the top, and then a few
not the same heat tiles as on the space shuttle. They are different. Are they ones that they won't talk about, but they are the next generation version ones of them.
Are they better? Yeah.
Considerably.
Yes.
I've got an alternative theory. Do you think this is just a giant trolling thing for nerds like us? We're just going to put an empty box in space for 2 years and let everybody wonder what we're up to.
Yep, and it's working.
Well, yeah.
I mean, the fact that they brought it back on autopilot is slightly interesting too, from my point of view, because it's not often you bring a space plane back at all and they tend to be piloted. So this is
one of the ideas that it could be used for, the final versions of it once they've got all the bugs, would be going up to retrieve satellites. Because you've got a payload space that's about the same size as a flatbed truck payload bay. So you could go up, pick up a satellite, bring it in, and then land it back on Earth all autonomously. You could do recovery missions.
Could you pick up somebody else's satellite?
That's an interesting question, isn't it?
Mm. So could clean up some of the mess too.
That'd be nice. Yeah, that'd be very public spirited.
Getting a bit crowded up there.
Yeah, good.
Here's the thing. Can they land it completely on autopilot, or is somebody doing like a drone piloting thing with a box and a fun thing with an aerial sticking out of it?
Again, an interesting question.
Okay.
They won't. There's a lot of things. They'll say it's coming back because it creates a sonic boom when
it
comes in.
I've seen the odd
so
self-driving car video and, the reviews are mixed.
I mean, the space shuttle had an awful lot of return automation. There's always somebody like as a back-level control, but they had 5 computers on board to do the analysis of the path.
It does some very clever S-shaped turns to slow down, which I didn't know about until I watched some simulations, and I was like, okay, this is quite complicated. If you were a pilot, it wouldn't be fun.
Interesting, the reason they had 5 computers was because they don't always come to the same conclusion. So by having 5 of them, you would always come to a consensus, because it's an odd number. There'd always be a majority decision.
It's like a jury.
Pretty much.
Landing a plane.
AI, horrible democracy.
Yes. Because the thing's got wings, hasn't it? So it can maneuver to some degree.
I think it's the same principles the space shuttle uses. It's not flying, it's following with style.
Yeah. Just from a launch point of view, it just literally gets bolted on like a satellite in a payload bay, right?
Correct, yeah.
And they don't like stick it on top of a rocket just hanging out there with the wings.
No, it's got a fairing which it goes up in, and it's got a second, like it's got a third stage for the rocket, which clips onto the back, which also has some sort of wings. It must do that in, again, lower upper atmosphere, low orbit stuff before it attaches that lower section, that aft section. It launches. Originally, the idea was to launch it through the shuttle. So you could fit it in the payload bay of the shuttle up and then launch this out as well. So they decided to go for rockets instead because solar wasn't economic.
Was it?
Who knows? Well, there was the not disclosed shuttle missions as well, but again, tin foil hat.
Yeah, we're being very naughty. but this is a real thing, which we're not making up. It does exist.
The pictures are cool.
It's a cool looking space thing. Mm-hmm. We know what it does.
Yeah. And it's up to something. That's all we can say.
And it is technically the only current space plane in existence, right? Unless you count the Virgin one, which is still getting off the ground.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I would argue that's not a space plane, though.
Because the Virgin one? The or,
yeah. Because it's not a orbital. Rocket, really. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going slow when you come back.
Yeah. It's also suborbital as well. Whereas this is the only, you're right, this is the only space orbital thing we know of.
That we know of.
Which makes it cool.
but it's interesting as well, though, isn't it? In the sense of we say, which we know of, but actually you can't hide them. Actually, you might not know what it's doing, but as we say, it comes in with a sonic boom, it launches on a huge rocket. Actually, there is a limit to how much stuff you can do in space and keep it completely quiet.
Yeah.
And amateurs can track it. You know, it's kind of intriguing.
No matter how good your new shiny thrusters are, it's hard to completely alter the orbit. I mean, making changing the altitude, those kind of things. But you know, you couldn't suddenly be in an equatorial one and then nip to polar.
Oh no, you can. You can. Sandra Bullock did it. I saw it. She used a fire extinguisher and jumped from like Hubble orbits to ISS orbits.
Okay, we're not going to base anything on gravity. That's gone well beyond the tinfoil hat grade into the true lunacy side.
Banned
of things.
From moaning about gravity. We'll have to do a special on it.
It doesn't work. Well, gravity works in the film.
Yeah, so going from unknown tiny things to unknown massive things. William.
Yes, so I'm not the unknown massive thing, I assume. So this is an intriguing story, which was about a supermassive black hole, which is pretty much exactly what it says on the tin. Intriguingly, and quite extraordinarily, I think, at the centre of pretty much every galaxy, we find a very, very large black hole. So historically, we used to think of black holes as being things which are kind of the remnants of a large star which had gone pop. And you end up with something maybe the same mass as our sun, which is a sort of a normal-sized black hole, should we say. Which is a kind of strange idea, really, isn't it? A normal black hole. but we have discovered in the centre of most galaxies, most galaxies we manage to peer into the centre of, there appear to be these things which are maybe millions of times the mass of our sun. So supermassive black holes. And we think this is actually a really important part of stage of the galaxy formation. And in fact, this is what you do, Ali. I shouldn't really be talking about this. I'm stealing your
I'm glad
your
I don't have to talk about them for a while. Yeah. And there's really good evidence for them. I mean, it's not like we've just made this up. It fits the observations really well. We don't know of anything that can support the huge amounts of gravity that you'd be talking about other than a black hole, which is just an infinitely dense point. But it does have a kind of a horizon that people talk about, and our local Milky Way, its supermassive black hole is large enough that close enough that we can actually resolve stars orbiting it at huge speeds, and we don't see anything else except something that every so often burps some X-rays in our direction. So we know There's good
something
evidence
there.
Right next door of this very massive object. I think it's about 4 million solar masses equivalent in this tiny little space.
We know there's something there. We know we can't see it. We know it must be of a rough mass because we can see things going around it. We can get the orbits from that. And we know how big it must be, or maximum size it can be, because again, we see things going around it. Yeah. And when you put all those constraints in place, the only thing that it could be is a black hole.
Yeah. Most of the evidence is kind of indirect, to be fair.
By definition,
it works with the numbers, you know, the Einstein's equations and things. You kind of need these to explain what we're seeing, but you'd now have the gravitational waves boost that discovery. Mm-hmm. Does help to solid up that these objects are out there and they do exist.
Yeah. So the intriguing thing is they seem to be in the center of most galaxies, which we have the ability to observe to that detail. And there also seems to be a strong sort of relationship between the size of the black hole and the size of the galaxy.
It's a very chicken and an egg thing.
Yeah.
Do you need a black hole to make a galaxy?
Exactly.
Do you need a galaxy first?
So
they just evolve.
One of the intriguing things is if that's true, if they're kind of merging, we think galaxies generally have come from mergers of smaller bodies. So smaller galaxies have collided together to build up to the big things we have, like the Milky Way. And so that means that in the past, there must have been kind of black holes merging. And so this observation, which we're talking about here, which people got excited about, was observation of a very early black hole, which is kind of a much younger galaxy than our galaxy. And in fact, we can see it, although it's a long, long way away, we can see it because the black hole is feeding So this again is something you know more about, Ali, but effectively there's a large cloud of gas which is getting swallowed up by the black hole, and as it does so, the black hole spews out lots of X-rays. So that's, again, it's an indirect way of seeing it, but there's only one way in which you can get such a strong X-ray source from a distance. Yeah.
So that's what gives you the AGN, the active in the galactic nuclei thing. And you, if you want to turn it up to 11, you go quasars, which just happen to be the more luminous versions of these. But yeah, feeding black holes are pretty bright.
So this is all stuff we know. This is stuff we've had seen before. So we know that there's black holes in the galaxies. We know if we look at distant galaxies, we see them feeding and we see X-rays from them. And the thing that's intriguing is that they're always at the center of the galaxies. And what they've managed to observe here is one where the black hole doesn't seem to be quite at the center of the galaxy. It seems to be offset from the center and seems to be moving at a velocity which is not quite the same as the velocity of the gas of the galaxy. Which has got people excited because they think maybe they're seeing a black hole which has recently, or a supermassive black hole which has recently merged, or has got a companion which perhaps isn't quite as noticeable, visible, because it's not feeding. And so they're going around each other and they're about to merge, which is, either way, is pretty awesome because, I mean, it's one of those things where it's that kind of thing of, we know this must be the case. We know you must have black holes which merge at some point in the history of the universe, but we haven't actually seen it. And here's evidence of one which has either just done its merger or is about to, which is kind of, frankly, quite an important observation of a piece in the jigsaw puzzle of galaxies, yeah, I suppose.
So this isn't an isolated thing. It's not just a supermassive black hole on its own without a galaxy following with it or anything.
Okay. It seems to be that it's in the galaxy, but it's not where it should be in the galaxy, shall we say. It's offset by a few thousand light years from the center of the galaxy, which is kind of strange.
And I'm guessing for the velocities they must have spectra for these things.
Presumably so. I'm not sure I've done that.
Yeah, you look at the spectral lines, you measure where they're supposed to be in the lab at rest frame, and then you can work out speeds and redshifts at the same time. So
and the awesome thing about these is that, you know, as you say, right now it's various ideas, but if these things are merging in the past, the gravitational wave stuff, we will, with the next generation of gravitational wave detector, we should start seeing these things colliding. And then we get this whole new view on the universe. You know, you'll start to understand how, you know, it's one of those, I don't know, you could argue, why do we care how a galaxy formed? But it's something about the fact that we live in a galaxy and we don't really know how it formed. And that's such a fundamental question, isn't it? It's like, how on earth did this thing we live in get created? And one of the steps, which is intriguing, is this. So here's a part of that puzzle.
I find it interesting. We're still not exactly sure how you get black holes this massive.
No.
Mergers obviously help. You can grow them at a constant rate, but when you start working out the numbers, some of these things are a billion mass black holes, billion solar masses, and it becomes very hard to do that from the beginning of the universe. So there's maybe...
In terms of time,
you maybe need to throw an unreasonable amount of stuff into it, but there's some theories that maybe you can seed these things earlier and actually give it a quick boost right at the beginning, and then it can grow slowly from that point on. So trying to work out exactly how these kind of things would happen is quite a lot of fun, but it's all so far back.
Yeah,
it's very hard to see a lot of this stuff. So I guess that's why everybody likes, well, I like quasars and AGN, because they're visible from an incredibly distant part of the universe. They sort of peak at around about a redshift of 2. And once you're above a redshift of
redshift.
Redshift is just it's the related to the expansion rate of the universe. So if you go back in time, the universe is smaller. And above a redshift of about 1, you're already at half the current age of the universe, and so on and so forth. Can you remember the redshift of the cosmic microwave background radiation?
It's like 1,000, isn't it? I think.
Something like that, yeah. So it goes up in a strange way, but basically it's very hard to look at anything higher than 2.
And so the higher the redshift, the older and the further away the thing is.
And the harder you have to work to see it, because the light has taken a very long time to reach us, and it's very faint for the same reason, because it's been... it's disappearing over the horizon, as it were. So quasars are nice because they're the luminous things that you can see at the largest distance, in effect. You don't have to work as hard to get observations of them. And if you want to chase the host galaxies of these objects, that can be very difficult because you need to soak them a lot longer on the telescope. Yeah. You don't tend to see AGN beyond a redshift of about 6. There's maybe 1 or 2 oddballs. But that's also quite interesting too, because AGN maybe... there's a period in the universe where they started getting hungry, and we think maybe our own Milky Way galaxy had a period where it was an active galactic nucleus and it was spitting out much more energy than it currently does. So even though it's a bit dormant now, it doesn't mean it wasn't in the past, wasn't active. So that's also very interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing which really excites me is the fact that we have, say, these black holes which we know of, which are small, sort of Earth, not, sort of sun mass kind of black holes. Which is not small, but it's pretty small. And then we have these supermassive ones, which are millions of suns. We have no evidence for ones in between. Okay, 35 for the gravitational wave detection, but really there's this huge range of unknownness where we think there must be, because things must go from little to big at some point, somehow, at some time in the history of the universe. Where are they? And that's kind of frankly exciting when we have a blinding hole in our theories. Well, it's not a hole in our theories, it's just a...
We get to find the things that are in there.
We need bigger telescopes.
A black hole theory that's full of holes.
We need bigger
telescopes, more money for astronomy and bigger telescopes, please. Yes, thank you.
I think one thing just to make clear is a term that you guys have used a few times here of black holes feeding.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's worth it. Black holes is often misunderstood and it's misportrayed a lot of the time. That you sort of think of a black hole, you think of it being a massive vacuum cleaner sucking everything in, or a marauding Pac-Man munching its way through the universe. This isn't really true.
No.
They sit in a single location, moving with the universe, but they're not moving different to everything else.
No, they don't, and they don't suck. They don't suck, no.
When things get close enough to it, they fall in through gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if there's nothing close enough, there's no force pulling things in beyond gravity.
Yes.
Yeah. As long as you're going fast enough, you could quite happily orbit a black hole as long as you were outside its event horizon. If you start getting too close, you're going to bash into things that will slow you down and... Mm-hmm.
But you've fallen in a spiral pattern. You circle in like you would any other gravity-pulling object. It's not a sucking force.
Right now in front of me, there is a microphone which has a certain mass. If next to it there was a black hole of exactly the same mass as the microphone, I would be no more attracted to the microphone or the black hole than they'd be exactly the same. They'd both pull on me in the same level, which is negligible because it'd be quite small. So it's always important to remember that. I mean, when there was that whole thing about, you know, the CERN was going to create black holes which were the size of a fraction of an atom or something for a millisecond, it's like, that's not going to get sucked into it, because there are other atoms which we're not getting sucked into now.
There was a good counter argument for that, which is the Earth is regularly bombarded by cosmic rays which are moving with way more energy than what the LHC is capable of producing, and we still haven't been swallowed by these black holes that are popping into existence. I don't think we need to worry about that.
Yeah, it's a good point now, though. Yeah.
It's just something that's often misportrayed. I think it's worth just clarifying.
Well, I guess the feeding thing then, the thing that makes it luminous is the fact that it takes time to fall down that plug hole. So when you're in orbit around it, if you keep throwing stuff in, the momentum, the angular momentum will get sort of smooshed together and you will get a disk forming. So that gets called the accretion disk. And the accretion disk can get incredibly hot. So if you're talking about a quasar, the energy coming out of that disk, it'll be an area smaller than our solar system, but you can have more energy coming out from that flat disk than the entire host galaxy put together. So all the stars in that host galaxy by maybe a factor of 100 in some of the most luminous of these objects. So something smaller than our solar system, you have a supermassive black hole in the middle, an accretion disk around the side, and just the energy that you get before this stuff disappears can be huge. We still don't know exactly how they work, so don't ask me for more detail on the disk. We just know there's a disk there, but we're not very good at working out exactly where the outer edges and inner edges of the disk are, and what other clouds of stuff there are. But this is the kind of stuff I have to study on a daily basis and get sad that I don't have all the answers yet.
Well, I think hopefully we've blown your minds enough for this week, so we will see you again next month. Thanks for listening.
Bye.